Well, hey, everybody. Thanks for joining me today on I Don't Care with me, Dr. Kevin Stevenson. Always appreciate you spending time with me as I talk to hopefully and usually very interesting healthcare related guests. And today is someone who needs absolutely no introduction. If you've been in healthcare longer than about, 5 minutes, you're going to know this man's name because he is synonymous with information and insights throughout the healthcare industry. Please join me in welcoming my good friend, Scott Becker. Scott, thanks for joining me on I Don't Care.
Yeah, Kevin, thank you so much for having me, Dr. Stevenson. My favorite podcast and my favorite podcast title, I Don't Care with Dr. Kevin Stevenson. There is no better title in the business. Thank you so much for having me today, and thank you. And you look great. You look like you're doing just great, so it's great to visit with you.
Thanks, Scott. Yeah, I really appreciate that. And hey, you know, I've got to give you a shout-out as well. I've attended a number of your Becker's events in Chicago as a reviewer and as a participant, and really, really just just stellar events. And you and your folks put on a wonderful event. It's always highly, highly informative, and always appreciate the invitation to come up there for that. So looking forward to my next one.
We're hoping you'll be there in April, Dr. Stevenson. No, it's a great pleasure. We're big on very participatory agendas. We like to have everybody involved somehow or another, and it provides people at least a little bit. Hopefully they come back after they're there. You know, it's not that they're going to learn anything new. It's more about, maybe you will, but it's also about just seeing what other people are doing, networking, coming back a little bit more motivated on Monday, a little bit more excited when you get back, you know, and inspired a little bit is the hope that we hope people learn something, they have some entertainment, they network and just come away just a little bit more excited to do what they do, which is hard work. So we appreciate what you all do. So thank you.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. Well, let's jump into, you know, you were on the show a while back, and we talked about healthcare trends in 2025. Hey, it's a new year. I can't believe February is almost over, but I wanted to have you on to talk a little bit about what are you and your folks seeing as the hot trends for 2026?
Sure. I would say that we look at a few different things. You look at, of course, just continued workforce challenges, but those are becoming more acute at the specialty level than I mean, and I could say that versus primary care. And I don't mean that it's the nurse shortage has been alleviated some. It's still very tight. It's still very tight in certain spots. But the nation and how we educate nurses has accelerated the last several years. So we don't feel like it was quite as behind the eight ball as we were. It's still very tough, though. There's about 175, 180,000 new nurses are produced a year, which is a pretty good number. We probably lose about that many a year, but you're talking about a population of about 4.5 million nurses and so forth, and so critical. Specialists are much more complicated. We're more and more in areas of the country where finding the right specialist for the right thing is very, very difficult. You know, as a physician and a hospital administrator, how hard it is to get the right people, the right specialist, and what shortages are. It's even hard for people like you or I that have more access than the average American. But to get the right specialist, I was on a podcast last year where there's one neurologist in a spot in Texas for 500,000 people in a time of incredibly increasing dementia and Alzheimer's. Similarly, one dermatologist on a spot in northern Minnesota amongst 500,000 people. And that's just very, very, those numbers just don't work. Oncology is about 2.1 million new oncology diagnoses a year. Again, the numbers just don't work. The information overload for oncologists is brutal. The ability to take care of people and not burn out is brutal. We're just very short specialists. Now, people say we're very short primary care, and we are, of course, but the basic math is people say we're about 200,000 primary care doctors short. And so the reality of primary care is as follows, and this is not the preference. I love my primary care physician. I've had this one for 30 years. I know in many places of the country, as soon as he retires, I probably have to find a concierge physician, which is no good. And so when I talk about trends, I look at the primary care shortage. I almost view that as lost, that we're going to lose the war on primary care. We'll have to make it up through lots of PAs, nurse practitioners, and others, and technology. But I sort of view it as we better fix the subspecialty thing. More and more you meet somebody who's got some sort of cancer, you know, and that just is an impossible situation. You and I are of the age where you'll plenty of people that have had horrendous diagnoses, and it's just really challenging. I think subspecialties, really, really hard. Primary care, we've got to find a way to make 90% of that done by PAs and nurse practitioners and so forth. And then in terms of nurses, technologists, technicians, all kinds of other areas, we've got to keep on working on those things. So that's one trend, is a workforce trend. A related trend, I would say, is the tiering of healthcare. And what I mean by that, we always had in healthcare two big different tiers, commercial insured versus Medicare, Medicaid, indigent. And obviously, those are two big buckets. Now, on the commercial side, you've got this further breaking down of tiers, and to where if you're, you know, in certain areas, just recently, cardiology practice where we live went concierge, dermatology practice, you have to pay an access fee, which is like being concierge. Primary care in Florida, I was with a friend recently, he's paying $5,000 a year for concierge to get access when he needs it all the time. You know, and he's got, you know, lots of different issues. But you've got this breaking down of additional tiers of healthcare where, you know, the super wealthy are going to pay for concierge stuff. The rest in commercial are going to have harder times getting access. And then you've got the Medicare, Medicaid populations, which has always been a little bit harder to access. And then you've got the indigent, which is really challenging. So you've got more and more tiers of healthcare. So far we've talked about workforce shortages and tiers of healthcare. The next thing I would talk about is the evolution of technology. Obviously, huge positive impact in a lot of places. Some places more on the administrative side than the clinical side, but a cascading amount of use cases, AI and technology. But I think the error that we could make is to think that it's going to replace the need for labor and people. I think it's going to be both technology and people to make a difference, to make it work. So those are three of the trends we start with. We could talk about medical education. We talk about the pharmaceutical world. There's just so many different things going on in healthcare. Margin pressure. When I talk about tiers in healthcare, the same thing applies to hospitals and health systems. You've got larger health systems that are relatively healthy financially. You've got small, independent, rural health systems really in trouble. Rural healthcare in our country is a really vicious cycle going in the wrong direction. You know, for all the discussion of ways that we'll solve it through remote care and other types of things, it's still very hard to all-inclusive do that completely. You've got labor and delivery closing down throughout the country just because shortages of OB-GYNs. And it's just in a rural community, if you don't have health care, you can't ultimately support a rural community. And you've got this vicious cycle as more and more of the young people move out of the rural community to the cities. You know, everybody wants to be in the 40 big metro areas today, and it's really, really hard to provide rural healthcare. And then it's really hard to have a great population that we've always had in rural America. So it's really, really challenging, the healthcare challenges in rural America.
Yeah, we definitely see that. Obviously, here in Texas, I think we're still leading the nation in hospital closures on an annual basis. But you're right. You know, throughout my administrative career, I've always been looking at how can my facility provide the care for the people in our area, you know, the best care, the most complete care. And we always want to do that. You know, as long as we could do that safe, we were going to do everything that we could. But, you know, and it may have been on my podcast last year because you brought up the one neurologist in an area of 500,000. And that's what we're facing here. And it's incredible, you know, and the recruitment. And I see that as being multifactorial. You know, we are a smaller town. Most new grads definitely want to go to a larger metropolitan area. And I get that. I mean, but there are incredible opportunities in areas like ours that, you know, Waco is a college town, very vibrant. You know, we have a rural catchment area with people who, you know, deserve high quality healthcare. But that's one. But the other thing, it falls under medical education, is because we're not allowing enough people within the specialty areas on an annual basis. You know, can we talk a little bit about that, Guy? What do you see?
100%. So this is really my favorite subject, is medical education. And medical education, we produce great doctors. We do so horrendously inefficiently and horrendously expensively. Mm-hmm. And I contrast it to the nurse shortage. And this is why I think this is so fascinating. Over the last few years, we've accelerated nurse education. We produce about 180,000 nurses a year, somewhere in that number, which is a remarkable number. Mm-hmm. Years ago, they said we couldn't produce anywhere near that many nurses a year because of nurse education, because we need to do rotations, other kinds of reasons. And we've expedited that tremendously. It's almost one of the things that's led to the takeover of primary care by nurse practitioners, by PAs and others. There's just enough nurses and PAs or close to it. There's not nearly enough doctors. Now, the medical education issue is as follows. Somebody in this country goes to 4 years of college, 4 years of medical school, 3 to 4 years of residency, often a fellowship, and they're not out practicing till they're 31, 32. And of course, by 40, 45, a good deal of physicians are part-time of some sort. Not fully, but some sort. And, you know, so with one of my close colleagues who's a healthcare consultant, his wife's a pediatrician. She now works part-time. She's able to do it remotely. God bless her. Fantastic. But this is the way of the world. You got a huge percentage of people going part-time by 40 to 45. We don't even get them into the workforce till they're 31, 32. And this is just a math issue. Number of doctor hours per our population at 350 million is just a really challenging issue. And when you talk about what you could do about this from the medical establishment, the thoughts are all over the board. I mean, obviously, nurse education, we accelerated the last several years. People would say it's imperfect. No question it's imperfect, but it's far better than producing 130,000 nurses a year. We're just in a much better spot than we were. On medical education, other countries, and we are the beneficiary of this, produce doctors that are ready to go by 27, 28. And we're huge beneficiaries of that. People come here from India, great physicians, thank God for them, and other countries too. India is the one that's most top of mind because, you know, but the person who replaced my mom's hips was from India, fantastic doctor, but was ready to practice by 27, 28 because he went straight to medical school. And again, that's not right for everybody, but there's no way we're solving this problem without accelerating medical education. There's just not enough people that, mm-hmm. I mean, there's about 20 to 25,000 medical school spots a year. There's about 20,000 residency spots a year. So we need more residency spots. We also need to make it shorter, more attractive. I don't care what anybody says. We want the very best and brightest going to med school. We're not just trying to fill up med schools. We're trying to get the best and brightest to med schools that are creative, smart, scientific, research, everything, that can do the whole thing. And not every single person has to be brilliant, but we want to attract the best and brightest. Right now, 50,000 people apply to med school. 20,000-25,000 get in. We produce about 20,000-25,000 doctors a year. We retire about 12,000 to 15,000 doctors a year. And we've got a huge aging, growing population. So, I mean, we've got to fix that. We've got to fix that so that people can be out of med school practicing by 27, 28. I mean, and when people say it can't be done, well, we have doctors here from Brazil, India, a lot of other countries. And thank God we have them. Thank God they come here because that helps to alleviate the shortage. And in a lot of those countries, they're done by 27, 28, 29, not 31, 32. And they come out with not as much debt and much more. And just there's got to be answers to it. It's not perfect. It's not perfect. You know, in the ideal world, somebody trains till they're 50, but that's never going to work. That's not reality. I mean, so there's probably some amount of like education, rotations, residencies, where you start to get to diminishing returns. And it's not, especially, you know, medical education in our country was developed prior to us having access to the internet. And we're still using a model that was built prior to the internet, which is just insane because the rote memory, I believe it's still important for people to really exercise their minds, really do rigorous work so their minds really work. You've got this whole generational issue of, do our minds still work as well as they should because we're so busy on our phones doing a million different things. But at the end of the day, we still need people doing rigorous work, even though we've got the internet and AI and everything else. But there is some balance in this. Probably could get people out of med school in 3 years, out of residency in 3 years, and it probably wouldn't be that big a difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I would agree with that. And we've been focusing a lot on physicians and nurses, but certainly the workforce issue is throughout healthcare. Yeah, you know, I mean, we had certainly issues with imaging techs and you know, MSTs and things like that. But it even goes to the retail pharmacy level. In my local retail pharmacy, I went in there and noticed, you know, they were overwhelmed with what they were trying to do. And so I was talking with the manager about an issue. I said, "You guys need help." And she said, yeah, she said, I haven't seen it this bad in my 20-year career, but you should see the applicants we're getting. And I think, I mean, and Scott, I believe we talked about this last time. Yeah, one of the big issues that COVID really exacerbated for everybody, you know, healthcare was always a noble profession. Everybody was interested in either being a physician or a nurse or whatever. But COVID showed people how difficult healthcare really is at the bedside or at the patient level. And so a lot of people said, you know, that works a little bit too hard for me.
100%. I mean, you have nurses, a close friend is a nurse, basically said, I want to go back to work. I want to do anything but be at the bedside. You know, and of course, yeah, the bedside's where you need people the most. It's almost like you get a whole generation, and this is not right or wrong, husbands and wives, the wife's the doctor, the husband's the spouse, the husband's doctor, the wife's the spouse, whatever it is, you got husbands and wives, they only want to go to the top 40 or 50 metro areas. And it's not, you can't blame them. That's your choice. They don't have to go rural areas. But so somebody says, I'll do any nursing, but I don't want to be the bedside. I'll do any doctoring, but I don't want to be in a rural area. That just, we got to figure out a way to solve that. And you're not going to solve it by forcing people. You're going to solve it by creating more doctors, more specialists, more nurses, and technology solutions. But some of them do require hands-on people, not just technology solutions. So you got to figure out a way to sort of create more doctors to where, you know, it used to be, and this is hard too. It used to be that you'd advertise in a smaller community. You're still getting better commercial rates. You're still making a better living. And that basically is, that's not, that differential is not there anymore. It used to be that somebody can go to a small, mid-sized town. He or she could be the king or queen of that town. They could own local real estate. They could do all kinds of things and be an entrepreneur. But that, those opportunities to make above market monies are much harder than they were a generation ago. So it's much less alluring. You used to have people like, obviously you and I are older than maybe our average audience. You used to have people coming out of the military that went to smaller towns, that went to different rural areas and so forth. But, and we still have people from other countries that will go to those smaller towns, and thank God for them. But we got to find a way to bring in more doctors and create doctors a little bit quicker.
Yeah, no, you're right. Well, let's transition a little bit. You touched on technology and AI, and I got to be honest with you, since I transitioned out of the C-suite and into advisory roles, yeah, you know, I'm working with, you know, dozens of companies now. Everything has an AI component, and I look at, you know, I'm looking at everything from rev cycle to supply chain to hiring to, you know, you name it, there's an AI component or MLM component in that. So let's talk about, how is AI really transforming healthcare? What do you see from 2026 and beyond?
Yes, no, I think it's, I always talk about it in terms of cascading use cases. So we've seen some use cases early on in rev cycle and some other areas where essentially you take rote tasks, automate, and you automate them that it was almost impossible to get people to staff to do anyways. And so you've seen that where people, you know, big systems will have thousands of people in revenue cycle doing very rote stuff. And more and more that's being automated through revenue cycle AI types of companies. Then you've got the next level of stuff is, and Cedars-Sinai just did a great training exercise on this, is when you look at sort of AI, you've got two distinct types of AI. You've got AI, which is sort of the individual case where you and I use AI as part of our daily life in a way we didn't some time ago. So, for example, if I have a podcast coming up, you used to have to sit down and write questions, think about questions. Now, within 10 seconds, I plug something into ChatGPT, and it gives me 6 questions for the person or whatever the number is, and it's largely as good or better. And certainly,
don't be giving away my secret.
You do a lot of this ad lib offhand without even sending out questions. So you don't cheat like I do, but it's you do this great job of it. But it's but what happens is, like, for so many of these things, and what I get to is individual use cases versus enterprise use cases. So what you see in systems is this effort to sort of move from all of us are getting exposed to AI in different ways. For me, it's mostly day in, day out, plugging in ChatGPT questions one way or another or something, whatever I'm doing, and whatever I'm looking at, thinking about, you know, and those are what I would call individual cases. Enterprise cases where how do I make this work throughout the entire supply chain? How am I having this AI read all of our contracts and figure out what somebody has to do? So, for example, if it used to take 2,000 man or woman hours to read through thousands of contracts. Now, hopefully, I'm having an AI type of solution do so. And I'm really highlighting to somebody or a few people, here's the six key things you got to look at. So here's what's important. And so I think it's not an easy answer. It's certainly a cascading use case. The last time I went to the doctor for something personally, I'll give you two different stories. One is I had my primary care physician physical, had to reschedule it from about April, and they told me the next available appointment was a year out, you know, which is standard today, literally. And that's just an impossible, incredible situation because, you know, if you wait a year or two, your cholesterol could be twice what it was. You could be in bad shape. It's like not getting a screening colonoscopy. All of a sudden, you have a serious problem because you haven't been able to deal with things. So, so one thing is just the doctor shortage issue. The second thing is I went to the urgent care for something. And of course, before I went, I Googled what's wrong with me, what's going on. I've got, you know, some issue, whatever it is. And what happened was fascinating to me is the ChatGPT answer. You know, I still had to go to the urgent care. Mm-hmm. I still had to have the remarkably terrific physician's assistant take care of me and do the prescription and everything else. But what was amazing to me is that what the AI told me was basically 100% correct as to what, and that's not for a complicated diagnosis for sure.
Sure.
But it was fascinating to see where these things could start to play in. But these are still lots of individual use cases versus enterprise use cases. You know, at some point, I assume somebody's going for their physical and they'll plug in the records, they'll plug in a few questions. Here's what you're thinking about. Here's what's going on. And the AI will help guide the physician to be that much more efficient or to see it from a PA or whatever it is. But I think you're going to see cascading use cases. Trying to predict it, you know, obviously there's areas where it's already happened. Predictive analytics, other areas, the rev cycle. We're already seeing really strong implementation of AI, ambient listening. Is somebody that something that's really moving along, which is taking away some of the doctor's need to spend so much time recording and taking records. So you started to see use cases really involve themselves and really be used and accelerated. Predicting the next use cases, for me, it's really observational. Like I would have never been able to predict that the iPhone would be as all-encompassing as it is for so many of us. You know, you and I grew up in a time when there wasn't iPhones, when there wasn't really cell phones. They were just becoming a thing. So the idea that the iPhone would have everything on it, you know, so much of your life on it and what you do on it is incredible. And I think AI and the evolution of it, I mean, the good thing is there's so many bright minds working at this, trying to figure out how to make it work and make it useful, you know. But we're not at a spot where AI yet does replaces that neurologist, replaces a psychiatrist. You know, psychiatrists, we've got horrible shortages, doesn't replace the brain surgeon. That's why I think as we move forward, AI is likely going to supplement a ton of PAs and NPs and others to do primary care really, really well with some primary care oversight. It's going to take longer to do it in some of the specialties, and we better figure out a way to populate some of those specialties or we're going to be in real trouble.
Yeah, no, I really agree with that. I know, last year before I left my hospital, we added the AI packages on both of our MRIs. And of course, yeah, as soon as the radiologists hear that, they start panicking. We're going to lose our jobs. Like, no, we're not. It's actually going to give you more time to read. And once they got into it, they recognized absolutely it improved their quality of life. And so I think we're going to see utilization of AI, as you said, across all specialties, but it just to enhance that, because you've always got to have a human involved, because AI is just going to give a very agnostic, very, you know, impersonal answer. So you've got to have that human to say, okay, that answer is fine, but we're talking about somebody in an emotional state or whatever. There still has to be a higher level decision.
100%. And I'll give you two examples of that, which I think is right on. One is people are using more and more of the GI products with their colonoscopies, different AI type tools, very much radiological, diagnostic, et cetera. And the gastroenterologists are using those heavily, swear by the fact that it's improving their ability to do what they do. That's finding stuff they wouldn't otherwise find, steering them to the right place, so forth and so on. I think that's right on. I think the fascinating spot is, you know, if you're a financial advisor, there's this perspective that, you know, my God, AI can replace me because like AI can allocate my portfolio better than I can, better than a financial advisor can, et cetera, et cetera. What happens is the financial advisor when the market goes down 3%, the person on the other side whose portfolio it is wants to talk to their financial advisor and get comforted and so forth. And there's a human plus technology component to all these things that I think is just so very, very important. And I don't think we're getting away from it anytime soon, you know, if at all. I think there's always going to be like when you're a patient in a hospital, and one of the beauties of healthcare is no matter who you are, you or your family's also a consumer and patient at some point. When you're at a hospital and that floor you're on at night, he has several nurses or people on it, that is far more comforting than when it's a floor that feels like a desert. You know, and that's sure. Partially emotional, partially real in terms of health and wellness, but it's, you know, I think it's both. I think it's people and technology for almost everything.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. Well, yeah, and I look at other topics that I see, that I hear a lot of people talking about, you know, the hybrid virtual care models and the personalized medicine, you know, all of it has that AI component to it. You know, we talked a little bit about access early on. And again, one of the good things about COVID was the broader acceptance of telemedicine. You know, I was at a facility back in the early 2000s in outstate Nebraska. And yeah, there's quite a few people out there. And as we said, not a lot of doctors. And so telemedicine was a real godsend for those people. But so many people just, you know, they were so bought into, I've got to physically see my physician or my provider. And when COVID happened and they couldn't do that, you know, telemedicine became more acceptable. And I think that's going to help us with our extension. We're already seeing that for primary care and specialty care as well. And then...
No, yeah. There's no way around that. It's a huge improvement, and it's great, and it's got limits. I mean, it's great, and it's got limits, like so many things. You know, it's like, you know, it's fantastic. It's a 2x solution versus a 10x solution. It doesn't replace the doctor, but gives the doctor much more time. We were talking a moment ago about the pediatrician. My friend's wife was a pediatrician. She's able to work remotely now, and she wouldn't be in the workforce if not. She just couldn't do it because of all the things she's trying to accomplish. And so thank goodness for the telehealth. It's a huge positive. For my parents who are 87 and 92, the telehealth has shortcomings because they'll be on the phone with the doctor. They can't quite get connected in the right way. I remember the last bad telehealth visit, my mom ended up in the emergency room, one because the doctor couldn't tell that she was dehydrated. That was one of the problems. She just couldn't understand what the problem was. And it's like, and the other problem was like, you know, even I do so many of my podcasts by audio. We're on video now, and even video is better than audio because we're both that much more fully present. And so there's still a huge benefit to being in person with the doctor, where the doctor really gets that gestalt feel for things. But I don't know if we're going to lose that just because of the efficiency issue, that there's no way around it. But there's still a huge positive when you go into the urgent care and feel like somebody actually looked at you, talked to you, saw you. So you sort of felt like they saw the holistic view of you versus just the telehealth. But there's no way around it. But to your point on telehealth, the first use cases for telehealth were radiology, because you just couldn't staff a lot of markets with radiologists. Those were the original use cases. Mm-hmm. And so even with the advent of all of the AI, all the telehealth, we're still in a spot where we have shortages of radiologists, particularly... interventional radiologists, but we've got shortages of doctors, even where we thought telehealth was going to solve everything, right? I was going to solve everything. So I come back to, we better do both, people plus technology. The technology is fantastic and getting better, but we also need doctors and just.
Absolutely. Well, hey, in the last few minutes, I want to talk a little bit about interoperability as well. I mean, we're seeing that as a huge topic of discussion, being able to provide the data across, you know, platforms for providers and payers and patients. And what are you hearing? What are you seeing about that?
Yeah, no, it's so, so important. It's obviously getting better. You know, it's like years ago, you'd go from one medical institution to another medical institution, and they wouldn't have your records. They wouldn't be able to find out anything about you. And it would be a huge hassle to get the records back and forth. And by the time you did so, whatever problem you had was likely gone anyways. And so the interoperability is a huge improvement. I mean, in general, and obviously when people say we should get rid of EMRs, that ship has sailed, and the EMR is so, so important to everything that we do, you know, and so forth. But when interoperability, in terms of the different technologies, working with the enterprise systems, you know, it's those are real challenges still. I mean, in terms of interoperability, and if you're an enterprise product, you're probably in far better shape. If you're an application product or somebody trying to sell into something as a point solution, it's incumbent on you to make sure that whatever you're doing works readily and easily with whatever enterprise program systems are using. You know, because at the end of the day, people's patience for trying to figure things out themselves, and not wrongfully so, has gone out the window. Like if you're picking up a new technology from a company or vendor that you're just going to help on something, it's almost got to show immediate usefulness, immediate ease of use. I mean, the genius of Steve Jobs was, and it's still true to this day, is the ease of use of the system that he developed. I mean, the genius of it. You know, I'm on an Apple iPad with you. I'm on my Apple phone next to you. I've got my Apple Watch on, and I converted from BlackBerry, Samsung to Apple just because of easy use of the platform. And people used to make fun of him for being so focused on design and stuff like that. What we would say today is he was so focused on user experience, but he was so right. And for anybody who's developing an app, a healthcare, whatever it is, you could be brilliant. It could be brilliant. But if it's not very easy for the doctor, nurse, technician, administrator, whoever it is, to use, it's useless. You know, and so, you know, or if there's a big learning curve for them to use it, they're not going to do it because they're too overwhelmed.
No, you're exactly right. Okay, Scott, any final words of wisdom for my audience?
No, your audience has got more wisdom than I do, Dr. Stevenson, but it's just a great, great pleasure to visit with you. Totally made my day. Thank you so much for having me. And how did you come up with the title, I Don't Care?
You know, I love that you asked that. It's kind of funny. You know, back years ago, and I tell the story every now and then, it was before I moved to Waco. I was with another firm, I had a kid that grew up with my oldest daughter. He called me up one day. He said, "Hey, you're real excited about his new job. He went to work for a B2B marketing company. He's telling me everything that they do." He said, "You know, we do white papers and podcasts and all this other stuff." I said, "Hey, you know, let me stop you right there. Good for you. But the owner of my company is incredibly frugal. He's never going to use all that." And this kid said, "Well, yeah, here's the deal. We're in 15 verticals, healthcare being one. We need content. I know you've been in healthcare forever, and I know how much you like to talk." He said, "Have you ever thought about a podcast?" I said, "Yeah, but I didn't know how to do it." He said, "Come in." So I went in. We started talking. We did a couple of test podcasts. You know, people actually listening and seemed to enjoy my format. And so we were, kind of knocking around branding and everything. And one night about 10:30, this kid calls me. He goes, "I got it." I said, "What?" He goes, "I got the net for your podcast." I said, "Right." He said, "You're not a physician. You're not a patient care provider. You don't provide direct patient care." I said, "That's true. And thank goodness for the patient's sake." He said, "But what about I Don't Care?" And I said, "I like it." And so we talked to a couple of people, and people seemed to like it, and we ran with it, and we thought about it over the years, and should we change it? Should we not? Should we soften it? And people were like, "No, we don't." Yeah. And so
I'm in that camp of absolutely loving the title. I just love the name of it. So fantastic. I just love it. You know.
Okay. Thanks. I appreciate it. Hey, Scott, great to have you on as always. I look forward to seeing you soon. Hopefully I get up there in April. If not, I'm going to come up in the fall for sure.
We would love it.
But as always, thanks for the invitation. And thanks for your time.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Great to see you. Well, folks, having the great Scott Becker on I Don't Care is always a pleasure for me. And it's also equally a pleasure having you listening and watching. So thanks for that. And we'll see you next time. Thanks.